Hi, and welcome to another episode of What's Going On in Banking. I'm your host, Ron Shevlin, Chief Research Officer at Cornerstone Advisors and author of the FinTech Snark Tank blog on Forbes. You know, we're typically talking about what's going on in banking, but today we're going to focus in a little bit more narrowly and talk about what's going on in fintech. And to help me do that, I have got Nigel Morris, the co-founder and managing partner of QED Investors, the premier fintech venture capital firm in the space. Prior to QED, Nigel co-founded Capital One, where he was president and chief operating officer. And Nigel, I got to tell you that my podcast bucket list has two people on it that I wanted as guests, Nigel Morris and Jamie Dimon. So I get to check off one of my bucket lists. Thanks a lot for joining me today.
Ron, it's a pleasure. Look, I don't know about premier venture capital firm, but it's nice to hear that you've heard of us. Thank you. And look, Jamie Dimon, I don't know if you just read his intro to his earnings report that he put out last week, but I think if not the most accomplished and perceptive banker of my generation, I don't know who's better, but a real class act. So I'm delighted that you put me in the same category as him. I'm not sure if it's deserved.
Absolutely. And I did see it and commented on it last week because his comments about AI were pretty interesting. And I also found that it was kind of surprising that this year he only mentioned two components of technology. Usually he talks a lot about technology. And this year it was a brief mention about cloud computing, which he's talked about before. And the other was AI. And of course, he gave a short comment about the downsides of it. But what I really found interesting was the fact that he was talking about how they're going to be hiring a chief data and analytics officer. Didn't say AI officer, but said data and analytics. And I thought that was pretty interesting. How about what caught your eye?
Oh, I think just how much energy he put behind AI and how it was going to create a massive step functions in productivity and in terms of how financial institutions deal with customers. I mean, you know, as we take a step back on it, I think we're going to see very substantial cost reductions, people driving down efficiency curves using AI. And of course, AI is just an advanced statistical tool, you know, and it's interesting that he used data science rather than AI as the rubric, because that's what it is. And, you know, in financial services, you know, our portfolio companies, Capital One, JPM have been using advanced analytical tools for a decade or more. So there's nothing revolutionary about it, but the impact now is starting to become a major step function. So substantial reduced costs, particularly in operations and in call centers, where companies like Albert in our portfolio and many others are now using chatbots to really reduce costs and improve efficiency. And then secondly, a story that Capital One used to tell, I used to tell, was that we had one-on-one marketing where we were able to surgically offer the right product to the right customer at the right time. The truth was we couldn't because we were largely using direct mail. Now in a world where you're digitally tailoring offer to customer, you can get down to one-on-one marketing. That means less noise for the consumer. It means lower cost to acquire and therefore all things being equal, better economics. Now, the question is going to be, as these tools become more ubiquitous across financial services, it's the entities that are able to embrace these tools and leverage them that will get the advantage. And those that don't will be at a substantial disadvantage. So much of this is not about developing your own AI. It's about figuring out how to execute, leveraging the tools that will become very much across the board over the next 2, 3, 5 years, and how fast this world is changing. So a lot of advantage in having people on the front foot focused on it. And I think that's what JPM are doing. I mean, they've built so much of the infrastructure over the last year's evidence, what Jamie has talked about in his last notes. Now it's about leveraging it and executing. I think that's the key here.
Nigel, you come out of the credit and lending world. You've got a number of companies in your portfolio that focus on that. Do you have concerns about the bias and downsides of applying machine learning and AI tools and technologies to that space?
Yeah, I think, some of the people I work with, will say, Nigel, you're still a bit of a Luddite. If you remember Luddites in the UK, they were the anti-industrial revolution northerners who would stick these clogs into the machines. Because I really do worry about the use of advanced statistical tools to predict credit risk. Because once the machine takes over, you can't ask the machine why. And you can't ask the machine how it trades off different variables. You know, so as you move away from regression analysis, where you can say these are the four variables and here's how they're weighted and here's how they interact, it becomes more and more difficult to unravel exactly what variables are being used and how they're being used, which means that generalizability from the backward-looking data that the models are built on can be suspect. So, you know, I've always said that let's build the basic models using simple tools that even I can understand, where you can see clear causation, and then unleash the really advanced tools on top of that. But don't let the machines ever entirely take over, because you could end up in a really dystopian environment where you don't know why the machine is making that decision, and therefore you can or you always have to worry about its generalizability. And the world is constantly changing, right? I mean, we're seeing interest rates now spike up in the last couple of weeks. You know, we're seeing student lending, being now back on the docket, where people have to start paying back those loans. The models were not built in an environment where those phenomena were in place. So you always have to worry about these machines. So don't let the machines take over. Have sensible people that are putting art on top of science in order to be able to really understand what's going on.
Great point. Nigel, I know you've been doing a lot of traveling in the past month or so. And are there things that you've seen outside of the U.S. that you think is either missing here in the U.S. or that you think would be interesting for U.S.-based banks and fintechs?
It's a really interesting question. And one we have all the time at QED, Ron. I mean, I've always been a passionate believer, back from my Capital One days, that an idea that works in one geography, the null hypothesis should be that it can be tailored and augmented and enhanced to work in a different geography. Nubank in many ways was a derivative of Capital One, a digital version of Capital One in Brazil. There will be a Nubank in India. Hopefully it's OneCard or Jupiter, companies that we've invested in. There one day will be one in Nigeria. So we really passionately believe in that. And therefore, there's a lot of ideas that can now seamlessly move across geographic borders. And often the Rubicon of a geographic border is seen to be higher than it really actually is in practice. And ideas transport much more easily than they did in the past. So we're seeing ideas starting to emerge, particularly in India and Brazil, where the regulatory climate is much more progressive than it is in many Western countries, including the UK and the US. Where as a result of PIX and as a result of these frictionless payment systems that are being built, we're seeing now an acceleration of innovation in those countries. We also have seen, if you go to Brazil or India again, where the underserved populations, their banking needs are being met and being supported by the unique relationship between banks and fintechs. So in the US, I've often said that by and large, the traditional banking system is not willing to serve nearly half of America. They don't have any money because they're living paycheck to paycheck. Certainly in this environment, it's really tough out there. And two, if they have a FICO score under, make a number up, 650, the banks are not going to offer lending to them. So for half of the consumers, the banks are not really interested in them. And the banks, of course, have got this very expensive fixed cost distribution system by and large. Now, JP Morgan and Chase and Capital One have rapidly moved to digital, as have some of the regionals, Key, Fifth Third. But by and large, our regional bank infrastructure, the thousands of banks that exist, are not embracing digital at a rate that the consumers are. So they're way, way behind. So the cost structures are high. And what we're seeing in developing countries is that you can leapfrog the fixed distribution system and go straight to digital in the same way as they leapfrogged landlines and went straight to mobile phones. So we're seeing a dizzying amount of innovation occurring in non-developed country jurisdictions. It's also spurred on, candidly, Ron, by just how much talent we have educated, particularly in the US, through our business schools and through Goldman and through Bain and BCG. Those people who have gone through that education and have seen the opportunity here now taking those ideas and moving them to their home jurisdiction. Certainly, you know, if you look at Nubank with David Velez, you know, Sequoia and General Atlantic and Stanford Business School. So many of the folks that we're now seeing on the ground in the US are going home to build out these models. And it's very exciting.
You know, Nigel, I don't think the problem is simply limited to the consumer side. The small business side is also a very overlooked and underserved. I did some research recently and came across a statistic and estimate that using the FDIC's definition of underbanked or underserved, nearly 80% of the small businesses in the U.S. would qualify as underbanked or underserved. Are you seeing innovative approaches to banking or lending to small businesses outside of the U.S. that could be brought here?
Your statement's well said. You know, so the by and large, traditional U.S. banking will only lend money to a small business if they can secure the loan, usually against commercial real estate or residential real estate. So, and if you're a startup and you're a newcomer and you don't have 2-3 years of track record, you can go and knock on your bank manager's door all day long, and he's not going to, or she's not going to make you a loan. So you're absolutely correct. And we've seen, people such as OnDeck Capital, people who have attempted to deliver it digitally, they were bought by Amex, and to some success, but still are only just scraping the surface of the opportunity that exists in SMB lending. Now, variations on it where you have access to proprietary data and where you have permission as a result of another service that you're offering allows sort of revenue-based lending for SMBs to emerge. So we would have Wayflyer in Dublin, we'd have Capitalize in the US, where they're offering the ability for small businesses to be able to lend against future revenues. And this is a space that, candidly, banks could easily have been in. They have access to small businesses, or certainly they're doing the checking account work with them. Of course, they have low-cost deposits. But this is a space that traditional banking has just not engaged in. So we see those kinds of models emerging, and emerging in lots of different geographies. In Mexico, we would have, and in Brazil, we're seeing small business lenders where you can access, for instance, in Mexico, you can access basically IRS data out of a central database. And that then gives you the equivalent of credit bureau data, a system of record that you can actually leverage that data in order to make loans. And we have Creditas and Confio and entities like that that are, Confio would be in that category. Creditas is offering auto lending. So yes, we're seeing it, and we'll see a lot more of it. We see MoneyPoint in Nigeria leveraging off data that they have. But I think your point is well taken. SMB lending, by and large, is an untapped opportunity, and it requires a lot of dexterity. Also often banks are leveraging off personal records of credit risk in order to make the loan rather than looking at the small business. And part of it is because it's harder to get access to that data, and it's harder to know that the data is correct. So it's taken a long time.
So it also seems to me, and this is actually going to bring in another topic I wanted to bring in. It seems to me that the part of the big opportunity to capitalize on this small business lending situation is to kind of integrate, have the financial institutions integrate with vertical SaaS providers that serve the particular industries that the small business is in, which kind of brings us into a little bit of the whole embedded finance piece as well. So I guess a couple things here. I know you have at least one or two companies in your portfolio that are vertical SaaS providers. Is that an area that you're bullish on? And do you see that helping to reignite the whole embedded finance, which has really taken a black eye over the past couple months?
Yeah. Look, I think the space is fascinating. If you take a half step back, and you can use the vertical SaaS framing if you'd like, anything that is analog and is moving bits of paper around in a company will become digitalized over the next, shall we say, 5 years. And as a result of that, costs will fall, efficiency will go up, and there'll be opportunity to use unique data sets that nobody else knows to be able to offer payments, insurance, and lending. Not only do you have that proprietary data, but you have windows when you can make very targeted offers. And with those offers, can be clicked to get, and it can be very seamless for the individual. So, you know, I'm thinking of Nuvo Cargo, which is a portfolio company that moves trucks and drivers and goods across the border from Mexico into the US. And at that, so they tap into the small business records and help small businesses move the trucks across. And at the same time, they can offer bespoke insurance, and they can offer payments, and they can do revenue-based lending for the insurance for the small business. So give them, you know, 97, 98, 95 cents on the dollar today, and the Nuvo Cargo will do the collections. So we're going to see payments, insurance, and lending wrapped into these embedded finance SaaS vertical SaaS opportunities occurring all over the sphere. It's very interesting because when I talk to the C-suite banker friends, I tell them that this is something that they could do. They've got low cost of funds. They often have relationships with the small businesses for checking, etc. But it's very hard for the banks to be able to figure out how to insinuate themselves into this system. And we're seeing these vertical SaaS plays start to really scale by vertical and then crossing verticals. And I would point to a portfolio company that's now public called AvidXchange that really has been doing this on one side of the balance sheet, but also money in and money out, and they start to become the system of record, increasingly wrapped around whatever vertical SaaS exists. So I think it's a fascinating space and really a lot of growth across the board that will undermine a friction for these entities and help them be able to grow seamlessly.
Are you bullish more broadly on embedded finance and the whole banking as a service space, from a consumer and other fintech side? Or what's your take on where this is going?
Yeah, tack on a couple of themes. One theme is it felt pre-COVID, which is just 4 and a bit years ago, that so many of the people running technology in the large incumbents were saying, look, fintech is largely a flash in the pan. These entities that are in the fintech space are not industrial strength. And the compliance people in the banks were saying, look, we can't go near them because the regulators are going to have a problem with it. I think that now 4 years on, it's pretty clear that there are many, many, many entities that are starting to insinuate themselves into the value chain. And the best banks are saying, look, we have a huge tech debt. We have so much to do on the tech front. We can't do it all. We need to become really good at curating other entities that can provide services to us, and then knitting together the best experience for our customers with the lowest cost and the most security. So, from entities like Ocrolus and Treasury Prime, Atomic, that would be in our portfolio, the best banks are figuring out how to join them up. And we're seeing more and more of that. So it's no longer, let's not do fintech, let's not focus, let's not work with fintechs, and it's not, let's do everything with fintechs. It's about mixing and matching in a way that meets the needs of a particular bank, leverage off what they're good at and what they're not good at. But I mean, the big embedded finance play of buy now, pay later, of course, has taken on massively, with the likes of Klarna, which was an early stage investment from QED. And what we've seen them do is really catalyze a structure, an old business model, which was basically point of sale installment lending in 3 or 4 lumps, and turn it into a great business. It certainly takes away friction. It's certainly clear that the ticket size at checkout goes up and checkout percentage goes up. So the merchant can win and the consumer has a great experience. And it looks like credit risk is being very much under control when you look at the numbers that are being published. So I think this is a really good thing for everybody. The key thing is that the buy now, pay later providers start to report to the bureaus so that it can help people who do make payments move up, matriculate up the credit ladder. So I think there's so much to like there.
Got a couple minutes left, Nigel, and I do want to get your thoughts on a very specific topic. I'd love to hear what you're seeing the next generation of fintechs working on.
It does vary, and there's so much going on, Ron. And it's almost like there was a bit of a 9-month hiatus last year when the excesses of the boom and bust that occurred in fintech put a lot of people back to basics and in their garage and not coming to market. But we're seeing, a vibrancy now that we didn't see 6 months ago, and maybe we didn't see 3 months ago. And I think that's really exciting. So much of it is not revolutionary. So much of it is the things we've talked about, financial inclusion, lending to SMB and to individuals. We're seeing earned wage access companies from DailyPay and Rain and PayActive and WageStream, Minu. We're seeing Refine in India. I think we've got relationships with more than half of those doing really well. So the ability to give consumers access to their money as they're earning it has taken off and is really now starting to hit its stride after a time when there were people asking questions about whether or not it was going to work. We're seeing, application of embedded finance across the board is really very interesting, and democratizing access to investing is increasingly showing up. It's hard to see, the next generation that are going to be able to compete with eToro and the Robin Hoods of this world, but there's a lot of really interesting things happening in that space. It's just so much of the ideas that emerge largely out of the West Coast first, and then are crossing the globe really quickly at lightning speed. I'd like to believe that the model that Credit Karma pioneered all those years ago, and then that led to ClearScore in the UK, I'd like to see how that model starts to emerge in new geographies as accessing a credit bureau becomes more and more important to renting a car and getting a job and getting your mortgage. We'll see more of that, and the bureau data becoming more important. We're seeing orthogonal data sets being used more and more. The rental data, paying your utilities, the money you have in your deposit account. Those data sets are clearly orthogonal and clearly work. And as we mentioned earlier, beware of using them indiscriminately with a massive machine learning model.
What about blockchain? Have you seen, or are you looking at anything that's interesting that potentially scalable from a blockchain, and not specifically just for to create a new cryptocurrency?
We were very cautious about this space. We've made an investment in Bitso in Mexico that's done very well, like a Coinbase for Mexico, if you like, and ShakePay in Canada. So we made some investments in the space, but our approach was always, look, we can help wrap the banking aspect of around crypto. So if you want to lend against it, if you want to move it, if you want to store it, those are typical banking skills that you would do against any kind of currency, gold or silver or platinum. So we have, but we haven't seen crypto yet take off as a means of transacting. And I'm not sure if we will. I think we're about to have a halving, aren't we? Is it later this week? So we'll see what happens there. Yeah. But
the metaverse, anything in the metaverse you see interesting, or is that past?
Who knows? I think it's past. I think it was a flash in the pan, but we shall see. I think figuring out back to PIL and embedded finance, how that fits into gaming, I think is really interesting. And how that starts to come together. We're having some conversations in that space. That's emerging. Of course, fraud management is important there. And by the way, the application of AI to fraud is, I think, much more interesting than it is to credit risk for the reasons we talked about earlier. But I'm with blockchain. We're studying it. We keep watching it. We've got a number of irons in the fire, but we haven't yet seen the industrial strength breakthrough that a lot of people have been suggesting. There are some arguments that inevitably it will happen, but it hasn't happened yet. And I think we have a tendency to think that things are going to happen faster than they do, and then when they do happen, they happen exponentially. So it's almost like slow, and then quick. So we shall see if we get to a quick scenario, but nothing yet.
Yeah, there's some interesting firms doing some things in the credit union space here in the U.S., Nigel. So given the collaborativeness of the credit unions, that might help to spur some interest in some real life use cases.
Yeah, I mean, the credit union as a distribution channel, I think, is fascinating. A portfolio company, Amount, just made an announcement last week with a credit union consortia and starting to sell what is really advanced analytics and lending management capability and some of the deposit products to the credit union. So I mentioned earlier that a lot of mainstream banking, certainly in the US, has not yet embraced digital at the right level that the consumers are, but an entities like Amount can start to accelerate that. And back to my value-added chain breaking up entities beginning to embrace that, I think that makes sense. And I think that credit unions have a very advantaged cost of funds. Another portfolio company, I feel like a commercial here, is Caribou, that does refinancing of auto loans. The fact that they can place those loans at an advantage cost of funds with a credit union makes a lot of sense.
Nigel, thank you so much for spending the time today. And for everybody listening in, it's been another episode of What's Going On in Banking. Hope to see you all at another episode. Thanks. Thank you, Nigel.
Pleasure, Ron. Thanks a lot. Take care.